morning, church. Oh, it's good to be here. I don't know about you, but I'm a little taken aback by the number of Christmas announcements we had just there. And you go to the coffee shop, and all of a sudden, it's all their Christmas drinks that are for sale. And yeah, that season is right around the corner. And when we're sitting through the announcements, my encouragement is to consider marking out some of those dates and just enjoy the season together with your spiritual family and some of the different events that we do together to make the most out of what's an important season. And along with this Christmas season will be, in a few weeks' time, we're going to start our Advent series, and I'm looking forward to that as we have the spiritual intentionality of looking forward to the celebration of Christ's coming on Christmas Eve. Also, looking forward to that service with you together as well. And in the next 2 weeks prior to Advent, we're going to wrap up our very short and sweet series on friendship. And today in particular, we're going to talk about committed friendship. And that's the title of the sermon, and you're already thinking, what does it mean? What does it look like? We have different ways of showing our commitment or our loyalty to some people. And for those of you that are deeply loyal, like me, maybe sometimes it actually doesn't work itself out in very healthy fashion. So this is a story that some of you have heard before, others of you haven't, but this is way back into my Bible school days when I was 18 or 19 years old. And one of the things I loved about Bible school is finding some friends. And they became my best friends, and we did everything together, except for one night when they all decided to go into the city without me. So I was at Prof. We're in the middle of nowhere between two cornfields, and one of my friends had a car, and he used it to take other friends to the city and left me behind. They said they looked for me, and that didn't hold water. I was easy to find. So I was mad at literally and figuratively being left behind. So I went on a loyalty revenge tour so that they would know I was upset. First thing I did, went to the dorm fridge, found all the food that was labeled with their names on it, and then ate it. And I drank their Pepsi, and that was wonderful. That didn't seem quite vicious enough, so then I went into one of my buddy's rooms and took out his Cheerios and crunched them in between his bed sheets so that he would be uncomfortable when he got back, because he deserved it. And then my coup de grace was, do you remember those little troll doll figurines from the 90s and 2000s? You know, they had the cool hair? I gave him a crew cut. Military style. And then, at the height of my mature response, I wrote on that troll in marker in Sharpie, "Mark sucks." That was his name of my friend, right? So then there would be no doubt as to where I stood with his decision to leave me behind between two cornfields. Well, why did I have such an emotional response? Yeah, you should know that your pastor is a human being, and there's times in my past in particular when I didn't respond very well, but I was incredibly emotional because it felt like somehow they had left me out. Somehow that they had violated our code of commitment and loyalty to one another. And perhaps you have also experienced stories, some lighthearted and some more heavy, of having felt this same way. So as we continue to explore the story of David and Jonathan, we learn that true friendship is committed. That this idea of commitment and loyalty is a requirement of a biblical friendship. Yes, they got close, they got personal. They really did share some of the deep, dark secrets of their souls with one another, and yet they also promised to stick it out to the end. So whether we are taking a look at some of our own friendships in our life, or hopefully being willing enough to look at how we are friends to others, we have much to learn in the area of committed friendship. Now, drawing our attention back to this story in 1 Samuel, having experienced these deep feelings of closeness and heartfelt friendship that we talked about last weekend, David and Jonathan then decided to make a covenant with one another to create this committed friendship that we're learning about. In 1 Samuel 18:3, it says, "Then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as his own soul." And so that's what we get at the very beginning, or the introduction to this relationship. But it's actually at the very end of this story in which we start to unpack a bit of what this covenant, this promise, was all about. And we read this in 1 Samuel 20:42. "Jonathan said to David, 'Go in peace.'" This is at their parting. "Go in peace, because we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever.' And he rose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city." And so they have sworn a covenant together. And far too often in my life, in our life, I think in the culture that we live in, Friendships are temporary. They're convenient. They don't often take the form of a covenant, of a promise of commitment and loyalty. It's easy to say, well, family is blood. Marriage, now that's a covenant commitment. Friendships, they come and they go. I think that would be often our natural approach to such things. And so we have examples in our life, the lives of the people around us, of where friendships haven't continued to be committed, where as soon as the going gets tough and there's conflict or there's distance, then even the best of friends can begin to fall away. And now again, not every single relationship that you have is going to reach this level, yet have we fallen into the trap of lacking certain commitment to those who are closest to us, those one, two, three others that really they would benefit from, our relationship with them would benefit from this level of covenant friendship. So what we learn from David and Jonathan first is that committed friendship makes promises. It is willing to say, I am here for you, and I commit to being here for you. So it is well worth our while to deepen our commitment to our close friends. And when we commit to them, and vice versa, we don't have to operate out of fear of losing them when we will not be perfect. So, church, we can only get up close and personal and share a significant part of ourselves and open up and be vulnerable when we know that there is some type of commitment on the other end. So I'd say even as we looked at the challenge of really seeking out this vulnerability last week, that it's inevitably tied to this commitment we're talking about today. We won't open up if we don't believe there's some commitment from the other side. So who has promised to stick with you? Who has determined to have your back? Who in your life has earned your trust in this way? I would say that these types of friendships, this commitment, is important for everyone. But for those who are not married, committed friends are the relationship where they can receive this type of promise and this type of closeness and this type of committed friendship. I mean, this is huge. And so last week, I had just made a reference to the fact that friendship is available to everybody, regardless of age or stage of life or marriage or even gender and sexuality. And the reason I say that is this, because we believe as a church at Stony Brook Fellowship, we believe in a biblical definition of marriage between one man and one woman. And that means that there are those who might deal with same-sex attraction or those who don't have that struggle but are single and are not necessarily planning on getting married. And then the Bible has a huge call on their lives. And that's the call of celibacy. That's the call of singleness. And that is a significant road. In fact, I can't even put myself in their shoes. I've been married for 18 and a half years. So it's easy for me to say theologically or biblically, oh yes, outside of marriage, you two are abstain from sexual relationships, right? That's not a part of the relationship that's available to you. But it's another thing altogether to walk through that. And so if you are walking the difficult and godly path of celibacy, for whatever reason, what are those relationships available to you? How do you still receive appropriate intimacy? How do you still receive someone who says, I am with you always? If someone is not married, it is committed friendship that leaves this available to them. And so church, even if we are not the ones walking this road, can we be friends to those who are? Not just convenient temporary friends, but committed covenant friends. Someone that I've read up on and talked to, actually interviewed for the podcast I'm a part of, is Wesley Hill. Wesley Hill is a gay celibate Christian, so he same-sex attracted, but he has understood that the Bible teaches that the definition of marriage is between one man and one woman, and so he is on this life of celibacy. And he has some amazing quotes about his own journey in this. One of the quotes is this. He says, "When I cannot feel God's love for me in my struggle, to have a friend grab my shoulder and say, I love you, I'm in this with you for the long haul." Did you hear that? I'm in this with you for the long haul. It is, in some ways, an incarnation of God's love that I would otherwise have trouble resting in. So he says, as I am looking for intimacy and as I am dealing with the struggle of celibacy, I need friends that are here and I need friends that are with me for the duration of my struggle. I need some committed friends who are with me for the long haul. And true spiritual friendship gives a real commitment, especially when the going gets tough. And this is valuable for all of us, regardless of what particular journey and path God has placed us on. But more than just a personal commitment or promise, a covenant involves the Lord. Hopefully you recognized as we read 1 Samuel 20:42 together that David and Jonathan swore an oath in the name of the Lord. So a promise is just a personal commitment between two friends. A covenant introduces a third party. It introduces God. And God is an active agent in covenant promises. He is active at the binding, where he witnesses these promises and he does something to seal that commitment. But God is not just active one time when a covenant is bound. He's also active in keeping these commitments in covenants. So inviting God into our promises allows us to rely on his dependability, not our own. For as much as I want to say I will stay committed, there are times in which I will not have the strength or the energy or the patience to see that commitment through. And so you require God's help to be the committed friend that those around you need and are looking for. Karen and I really enjoy being able to build into those who are just about to get married, and we talk a lot about covenant, and that is an example of a covenant relationship. And this is one point that we really hope will rest and be driven home, saying that on your marriage, on that wedding day, God is active there. He binds you together. He takes two people and he makes them one. But that is not the last time that God is interested in your relationship. Each and every day, he wants to be active in this marriage, active in this covenant. And each and every day, he wants you to rely on his dependability, because God always keeps his promises. And he can also help you keep yours. So rely on his dependability through prayer. Simply ask God for help. Ask him to fill you with his Holy Spirit. Ask him to give you the patience that you need for someone whose friendship is costing you something right now. Ask for his dependability and you will receive it. And when we rely on God as part of these committed friendships, I can think you can watch these relationships take a huge step forward. In your closest friendships, make promises of commitment and rely on God to help you see them through, and it is worth it. One of the other lessons that we take from David and Jonathan is that committed friendship is loyal. It's loyal. And loyalty and commitment are close, but there's some distinctions. I think the best way to understand loyalty is to define it as whose side are you on? Whose side are you on? And one of the easiest ways for us to understand that is cheering for a sports team. When we cheer for a sports team, that is often, where does your loyalty lie? One of my colleagues, Pastor John, I worked with him for all 10 years in Stonewall, and I love the guy. He's a man of integrity. He does not have one sports loyalty bone in his body. So John had pastored in three areas. He started by pastoring in Saskatchewan, and a lot of his wardrobe was green, and he would say weird things like, "Go Riders," and he would, you know, he was just in there, and then all of a sudden God called him to Stonewall, and all of a sudden the green left and all his wardrobe was blue, and then he had this wonderful experience of winning multiple Grey Cups in Manitoba. And then at the same time that I left to come here, he went to Airdrie, just outside Calgary. Now his wardrobe is red, and he goes to Stampeders games, and I'm like, I can't stand his sports loyalty. He just does not care. He just wants to be with wherever he is with the crowd. Now, he's a man of integrity, but just not when it comes to sports loyalty. Others do it different, right? Others in our church have been born in Saskatchewan and their wardrobe stays green. And they will, out of complete loyalty, but ultimately misdirection, cheer for their team this afternoon as the Riders get very close, but not quite, to winning the Grey Cup. If you want to know what it means by loyalty, who are you cheering for? Whose side are you on? And in committed friendship, we really don't want to be a fair-weather fan. Let your friends know that you have their back, that you're looking out for them, that you are defending them. We see this happen in the story that we're going through as well. Jonathan's loyalty to David was tested in an extreme way by his own father and the king. So the one who demanded loyalty of Jonathan on two different ways, I am your father, I am your king, he grew jealous of David, and he was so jealous of him, seeing him as a threat to his throne, that he wanted to end David's life? And how would Jonathan respond? Whose side was he on? I'm going to read for you from 1 Samuel 19, the first 7 verses. Saul spoke to Jonathan, his son, and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted much in David. And Jonathan told David, "Saul, my father, seeks to kill you. Therefore, be on your guard in the morning. Stay in a secret place and hide yourself. And I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you, and if I learn anything, I will tell you." And Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, "Let not the king sin against his servant David, because he has not sinned against you, and because his deeds have brought good to you. For he took his life in his hands, and he struck down the Philistine," that's Goliath, "and the Lord worked a great salvation for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by killing David without cause?" And Saul listened to the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, "As the Lord lives, he shall not be put to death." And Jonathan called David, and Jonathan reported to him all these things. And Jonathan brought David to Saul, and he was in his presence as before. So in this part of the story, at least, when Saul wants to harm David, Jonathan can talk him out of it. But when it came time, Jonathan's loyalty proved to be with David, because Saul wants to wrongly kill David. And Jonathan shows his loyalty in a few ways. He warns David about the danger so he can get to safety. He defends David when David's not there to defend himself. And he's able to change Saul's mind, at least this time. Where it would have been easy and even expected to just submit to Saul's command because he's the king and he's his father, Jonathan proved his loyalty and committed friendship to David. If you were thinking about this through the idea of fanship, he is on Team David. But now the question comes, what does this mean for loyalty in our relationships? Well, I certainly don't want us to read this story and think that the takeaway is choosing friends over family, because that is not the lesson that we are to learn. The problem of this story was that Saul was acting out of jealousy and murderous rage. He was being sinful. His course of action was not God-honoring. Instead, it was evil. Jonathan chose to not obey because Saul was in the wrong, not because he chose his friends over his family. It does mean, the lesson we are to take away from this, is that when we make a commitment to someone, we need to be willing to see it through, even when there is pressure from the outside to do differently. Right? Even when there's pressure from family or from friends, even when the situation gets hairy. Again, Jonathan was going to lose much by staying close to his friend David. This commitment was going to cost him something. Again, this self-sacrificing love of Jesus is the bedrock of this friendship, and Jonathan is willing to pay this price over and over again. So even when pressure comes from family, even when staying loyal might cost you something, even when other friends may put pressure on you, are you willing to stay committed when that friend is still in the right, when they need someone in their corner, when they need someone to defend when they can't defend themselves? But even as we make this point, even as we learn this lesson, we need to do so with an important qualification, that we always need to be discerning in our loyalty. Once again, Saul was able to dismiss his father's advice and his wishes because it was sinful. It did not honor the Lord. David was the one who was spiritually mature and doing the God-honoring thing. And I would be willing to bet anything that if the roles were reversed and David came to Jonathan and said, "Hey, I think I want to take over the kingship now. Let's plot to poison the drink of your father and take the throne for myself." I think if that was the situation, then Jonathan would have chosen his loyalty differently. So it's not about blind loyalty. I made a covenant and I'm going to be with you no matter what you do or decide. It is discerning loyalty. What is honoring God? What is the best course of action? What is the thing that the Lord would have me do? Be discerning in your loyalty. Because loyalty and true friendship is not a blind loyalty. It's not an invitation to stay in toxic relationships. I don't want you to misunderstand me. Be committed to those who are also committed to you. Seek after friendships for those who are pursuing Jesus the same way that you are called to pursue Jesus. And if there are times in which there is a relationship that is toxic and it's sinful and it's harmful and hurtful, then it is okay to take yourself out of that situation. Be discerning in your loyalty. Ask God for guidance. Look at the actions and the outcomes of what people are doing and say, is this a God-honoring thing? Go to mentors who you trust and say, hey, these are the dynamics of this relationship. Is it a good idea to stick around? Be discerning in how you can stay committed to those who God has called you to and who are willing to repay that commitment back to you. So committed friendship, we know that it makes promises, we know that it is loyal, it also stands the test of time. And this is often where our truest friendships are revealed. David and Jonathan made a covenant to one another, but that covenant, if you noticed it when we read 1 Samuel 20:42, was not limited just to each other. It says, we have sworn both of us in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord shall be between me and you, and between my offspring and your offspring forever. So right from the outset, right off the bat, David and Jonathan want this covenant and committed friendship that goes beyond even their own lifetimes. And once David and Jonathan finally go their separate ways, tragedy strikes the house of Saul. Both Saul and Jonathan are killed in battle, and David mourns them both. This is one of the things that really reveals the character of David. That after Saul would have sought to do him harm over and over and over again, when finally Saul meets his end, David mourns for him and grieves for him, but he saves his most emotional grief upon learning that his best friend Jonathan was killed in battle. Just an example of this heartfelt friendship. Again, a reminder in 2 Samuel 1:26. David is lamenting Saul and Jonathan, and he says, Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary. I love that. Your love to me was extraordinary. Surpassing the love of women, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war have perished. David is in true mourning. He's in true grief because his friend that he was up close and personal to and committed to had been taken away far before his natural end. And so the question then becomes, what happened to that friendship after Jonathan died? Again, he's no longer with David. David is now going to inherit this kingship. He's going to step into that rightful throne that God had chosen for him, and then Samuel, his prophet, had anointed for him. And so he now has all the power. And nobody is around to say or do anything towards this covenant that he made with Jonathan. Jonathan's not around. David has everything that God has promised him. Will he stay true to this covenant that he made with his friend? Well, we read this in 2 Samuel 9, verses 1 to 8. And again, this is a good story to remind ourselves of. Then the king at this point is David, called Ziba, Saul's servant, and said to him, all that belonged to Saul and all to his house I have given to Saul. Did I write this down wrong? What is the... I'm going to read it off the screen. We're going to do that. And David said, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul that I may show kindness for Jonathan's sake? How can I keep this covenant? Now there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and they called him to David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? And he said, I am your servant. And the king said, is there not still someone of the house of Saul that I may show kindness of God to him? And Ziba said to the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. The king said to him, where is he? And Ziba said to the king, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo-debar. Then King David sent and brought him from the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, at Lo-debar. And Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, son of Saul, came to David and fell on his face and paid homage. And David said, Mephibosheth. And he answered, behold, I am your servant. And David said to him, do not fear, for I will show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. And I will restore to you all the land of Saul your father, and you shall eat at my table always. And he paid homage and said, what is your servant that you should show regard for a dead dog such as I? What do we make of this? when we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that David is giving Mephibosheth an incredibly rare honor. Normally, if you would have a new king that would rise up, he would get rid of, remove, kill, exile all of the near relatives of the former lineage, of the former king, because they presented threats to him. They could have a claim to the throne. And so everybody would have been expecting not only a lack of kindness, but exile or death from the new king to Jonathan's son. That's what is expected by Mephibosheth here when he refers to himself as a dead dog. And instead of doing what's expected, instead of the normal, not only does David have mercy on Mephibosheth, but he honors him. He gives him lands that his grandfather Saul would have had, and he invites him to eat at his own personal table. He holds him close. He gives him honor and dignity and respect, and he does all of this for Jonathan's sake. He does all of it to stay true to a commitment and a covenant that he made, even though his friend is no longer around. And so we do learn that committed friendship stands the test of time. David and Jonathan's friendship extended for years beyond even the grave and to loved ones, all based on the covenant that they made with one another and by relying on God's dependability to see it through. I think this last point, this standing the test of time, is not so much a goal, something that we achieve, as it is just a result of living out biblical friendship, true friendship with one another. Heartfelt friendship gets up close and personal. It shows sacrificial love. Committed friendship means you're around for the long haul and you stay loyal. And when you work for these things and seek after these things, then the natural result is that your friendships will stand the test of time. I really appreciate the fact that I can share these stories about my Bible school experience and my friendships, and I'm still friends with these guys. So the guy whose hair I cut off, and the Cheerios I put in the bed, and the pop that I drank, the guy with the car that left me behind, I'm going to his house to watch the Grey Cup this afternoon, right? And I love that he would even stick around after all of that, misguided loyalty from years beyond. I appreciate that there is evidence in my life that God has placed people in my life that are willing to say, I am with you for the long haul. That is a blessing to me. I appreciate them greatly. I hope you have many friends like this in your life too. Still, there is always a tendency for friendships to grow apart over time, and some of them will, and to an extent that is going to be okay. Again, not all of your friendships are going to look this way. There are many factors in this. Sometimes we move away and the distance grows. Sometimes you end up getting married and then life just changes and you're focused on that relationship primarily, and so friendships just get on the back burner. Sometimes being married isn't what does it. It's when you all have kids and you never have any time for anything anymore. You can be too busy with careers. You can have not a great habit of keeping in touch. And before you know it, a friendship may be boiled down to just updates on social media feeds to know what so-and-so is doing these days. And I really wonder, that maybe God is nudging you. Do you have one or two friends that maybe you could look at re-engaging with? People that used to be so incredibly crucial. People that you know are heartfelt and committed and loyal to you. Is there even one person that God might be leaning on you this morning to say, hey, that friendship, that one might be worth re-engaging. That might be worth circling back around to see, can that be a friendship that stands the test of time? And I think that if you're willing to do this, you may be pleasantly surprised when you pick up your phone and give them a call if you're over 40, or if you text them if you're under 40, and see what the response might be. Because there are rare friendships that stand the test of time, and it can be such a blessing to pick them back up. Again. So as we come now to just the last and final sermon in this series next week, I want to make this overly simple. And I'm going to make it so simple you'll say, why did we even bother listening to you for an hour so far? Last week was all about getting up close and personal with true friends. Be willing to be vulnerable and allow them to be vulnerable with you. This week was all about staying up close and personal. Be committed to them. Have their back. Cheer them on for the long haul. And next week, we'll focus on what we can do for one another as we live out these up close and personal friendships. Something to look forward to. Let's pray as we wrap up our time this morning. Heavenly Father, we think once again of the gift of your Son. We're looking forward to being reminded of that first advent of his coming, to take on flesh, to show us what true friendship looks like, to prove what true friendship looks like on the cross. And I thank you for your commitment of love and grace and mercy, for your dependability on keeping your promises that we can not only rely on for ourselves, but rely on in our relationships with others. So Father, may we too be a group of people that at the end of the day, just like David said of Jonathan, that people could say of us that our love and our friendship was extraordinary, unusual, above and beyond the norm, not because of what we are capable of, but what you are capable of. We pray this in your name. Amen.